the point x and the point y. So we compute the propagator g of x and y. And we did something quite neat. We managed to write it as the sum over paths, which takes some time t, and we sum over the paths that go from x to y, exponential of I some action x dot square plus m square for the particle, for the path, and an action which weights each path that takes particle from position x to position y. And we saw that by introducing a metric and integrating over it, we could also write it as some integral over paths e to some I m integral of just the length. This was just the length. Okay, so we sum over paths. The longest paths are more suppressed. The shortest paths are less suppressed. And this is a neat way of describing the propagator from point x to point y. Okay, then we studied the propagation, the same propagation from x to y in the presence of a U1 gauge field a mu. So it's a one form, but it's not a matrix, it's just a number. And we saw that this propagation in the presence of this gauge field g of x and y was given by some integral over paths, exponential of the action associated with that path. But then we have an average with an observable, which this is basically the Wilson loop, which is the exponential of I, E is the charge, the integration of A mu at position x, which depends on time, times x mu, x dot mu of t dt. Okay? So this is an integral along this path. And this is what we should do. We should average with this extra phase if we want to describe the propagation of a particle in the presence of a gauge field. And we saw, for example, that if we have some magnetic field B, say in some solenoid or something, then if we compute the difference of the two paths, so if it's the difference, I would write some contour integral. This is for the phase acquired because of the magnetic field, because I'm computing the difference in phases, I would compute this kind of contour integral. This would be just the integral over this surface of B, and this is just the flux through this surface. And of course, this is a physical observable that you can observe in a laboratory. It's something gauge invariant, well defined. You can make a gauge transformation. A goes to A plus derivative, and you can check that this is indeed gauge invariant, as it is, because you see that it's just a magnetic field that appears. So the magnetic field is, of course, gauge invariant. It's an observable. And for that, it's important that the loop is closed. If the loop is open, then it's not exactly gauge invariant. But we will discuss at length the gauge invariance or gauge not invariance of several objects during today, so don't worry too much about this. Finally, we generalized and we considered the propagation, again, from point x to point y with a non-abelian gauge field. So we have some color gauge field, like in chromodynamics. So we have some A, which is still mu, but which is now a matrix AB. And we saw that in this case, it was almost the same thing, except that G of X and Y, which is now a matrix, would be, again, the integral over paths, some action. But then we have this path order exponential of the integral of this gauge field, A mu of X of T dotted with F naught of T dt. Okay, with some electric charge as well. Okay. And what does this object mean? Well, when deriving this, we derive this by path integral, by writing the propagator as exponential of t times an Hamiltonian and breaking this time into small pieces. And as I told you, when this is a matrix, it doesn't commute, these small pieces. So you have some path which goes here. So this is x of 0, this is x of t. And by this object, I mean you discretize into small pieces and you consider a product of the exponentials for the propagation of these small pieces where you can linearize this. Okay? Very good. So since there were some confusions at the end about this definition, I want to discuss a bit more rigorously the definition of this path order exponential. Okay? This is something that you probably saw already with time order when doing quantum mechanic perturbation theory. But okay, we are not in a rush to go anywhere, so let's do it. Okay, so let's do this definition a bit slower. So this is on the definition. So I was telling you, let's first define something trivial, just the exponential, usual exponential. From 0 to t, I e a mu of x of t dot x mu of t dt. First, you are already getting tired of writing this, at least I am, so let me call all of this, which is some function of t, m of t. I call it m because very soon I will say that this is an abelian gauge field, then this is a matrix. For now, it's of course just a function, but let me call it m of t. Okay? Just to anticipate what comes next. Then what is this? So, well, definition one tells me, okay, one way of computing this exponential. Actually, maybe I'll start by what in my notes is definition. Okay, so one definition is just, I just expand this, and this is 1 plus integral from 0 to t, m of t dt, plus 1 half integral of this integral square, which I write dt1 integral dt2, m of t1, m of t2, and then I go on, plus 1 over 3 factorial integral dt1, dt2, dt3, m of t1, m of t2, m of t3, plus, good. So this is one definition. It's perfectly okay. Another definition, which is equivalent, of course, whenever you define things more than once, this is not really a definition. This is rather a claim. But another alternative definition is to say that, okay, this is nothing but the exponential of I break this into small pieces. So I epsilon m at the point xn, then the exponential I epsilon m at some point xn minus 1, where I discretize, tac, 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 up to exponential of I epsilon m at some point x1. Okay? And of course, exponential of a product. Product of exponentials is the exponential of the sum. And then I go back to my definition, my first definition. Right? This is just exponential of the sum, and the sum is an integral when I discretize. Okay? So I just discretized, and that's it. Finally, there is another definition. Let's say that this is our object, say, okay. The other definition is as follows. Suppose I consider the following differential equation. Dt minus m of t acting on some function, psi of t equal to 0. Okay? With what boundary conditions? With the boundary conditions. So this would be definition 3. Definition 1, definition 2, definition 3. I say that the boundary conditions are that psi of 0 equal to 1. Then, psi of capital T is equal to this exponential, to the guy that we want to compute. So it's another definition. 0 to t, m of t, dt. Okay? So, is this completely obvious for everyone? I mean, this just tells me that the derivative of log of psi is m of t, so log of psi is integral of m of t, so psi is exponential of integral of m of t. Right? Just differential equation. Is this clear, that the solution is that exponential? Yeah. It's also clear from this expression. Look, this is a useful exercise. So suppose I take derivative with respect to t of this guy. What do I get? The one dies. This guy gives m of t. This guy gives integral of m of t. So this one gives m of t times 1. This gives m of t times the integral of m of t, which is the first term. So you do reconstruct m of t times, again, this sum. Okay? So if you explicitly check that this guy obeys this differential equation from this expression, you see that it works. Right? Because you take one derivative, this gives 0, this gives m of t, and indeed m of t cancels with the 1 from here, and so on, and you check that this works. So it's easy to check that it's compatible with this one. It's also compatible with definition 2, because I take a derivative, only with respect to the last guy. This is the end point, which basically means that I ignore all of this and go here, and I take the derivative only here of this guy. And this just gives m times everything else, which is just a Wilson loop again. Okay? So you can then think for yourself and see that all these definitions are absolutely equivalent. Now with another color, let's say what would the definitions be for the non-abelian gauge field. Okay? So in yellow, so you have another pen. This is for the non-abelian one. Okay, let's start by the easy ones. Okay, so the path order exponential. So now we have path order. And this definition holds. Definition 2 is okay. The only difference is that now I'm multiplying matrices. So there is A1, A2, A2, A3, etc. up to here. An minus 1, An, probably. So A1, the first index is this guy, probably An, An plus 1. Okay, good. This is one definition. I just multiply, and some of you were confused why this is not just the same as just exponentiating, so let me explain this a bit slower. Now, look, this is a matrix. So the claim now is that definition 3 is also okay. But now, this guy is a matrix. This guy is a matrix. And by 1, I mean the identity matrix. Let's check why this is okay with definition 2. Because of exactly the same reason. When I take derivative, I only take to the last guy. So it only acts on this first exponential. So it just gives, again, that matrix times the full guy, which is exactly what we wanted to show. Okay? So these two definitions are indeed the same. Okay? But now, in general, you have some matrix, which depends on t. You have to solve this differential equation. It is not just the exponential, because it's not just exponential of the integral of a matrix. That's simply not true. You can check that it doesn't obey. So what is the analog of definition 1? Okay, let's see. What's the analog of definition 1? That's the only thing we want to understand. So let's look at definition 2, where you just discretize. This is what came out of the path integral derivation. We just discretize. So then, the path order exponential of the integral from 0 to t of m of t dt, again, let me emphasize, this is a matrix. I'm defining this for any matrix. Do you see well if I write in yellow, or should I go to white if I'm going to write for a long time? It's okay? So what is this? So first, if I don't pick any power of m, I get just the identity matrix. Okay? Now suppose I pick one power of m. If I pick one power of m and I expand these guys, I just get epsilon times a sum of all possible m's. So the second term so far doesn't differ from that definition, plus integral m of t dt. So far so good. That is okay. But now suppose you pick two terms, two m's. From this expression you pick two m's. Now you pick one m somewhere here, you pick some other m somewhere here, and you sum over all possibilities. But now, this one is always before this one, as it's ordered along the path. So now,
I have plus, I have two matrices now, one at time t2, one at time t1, but t1, say t1 is the second matrix, is always at the time before t2. So if I integrate dt1 from 0 to t, as we see from that definition, dt2 is always, in this definition, bigger than t1, so it always goes from t1 up to t. Okay, so t2, this matrix here, it's always at a later time compared to this one, so when I expand, the continuum limit is this. Okay? And you see that this region here, it's just a triangle, and it is 1 over 2 factorial of the total, if you want, integration region. What about the next term? I have some integral, dt1, dt2, dt3, m of t3, m of t2, m of t1. But again, when I expand, t1 always appears more to the right. Then there is t2 at some later time, and then t3 at some later time. So if I integrate t1 from 0 to 2, t2 is after t1, starts at t1 and t3, and t3 is after t2, it starts at t2 up to 3. And this is 1 over 3 factorial of the total region. Right? So this plus dot 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 would be the definition 1, if you want. Okay? Now, notice that if they are numbers, if they commute, this is symmetric in T1 and T2. This is absolutely equivalent to that. If they are just numbers, I mean, M of T1, M of T2, it's symmetric in T1 and T2. I can integrate only after on half of the integration region. Similarly, if they are numbers, this times this is symmetric. I can integrate only in 1 over in a given partition. Right? So this, of course, is a general case of that. So the idea is we can, for example, forget about this definition. This one works for both. Works for U1 or non-abelian. Okay. Very good. So this was about just defining what we were speaking about. What comes next? So what are we going to do next? Any question, Hal, about the definitions? I hope it's everyone is happy with the definition of this object. First order exponential, we have several definitions. You can solve a differential equation, you can do some power expansions with nested integrals, or you can discretize. They are all equivalent. Choose your favorite one. Very good. So we came to the following object. So this was just motivation for studying an object called the Wilson loop, which depends on some loop. Okay, some loop on spacetime, which is given by the path order exponential around that loop C of this matrix M of T. Okay, and sometimes I define it with a trace here at the very end. This is a matrix, sometimes not. Okay, sometimes no trace. Okay, good. So first, we saw that it is related. So why are we studying this object? So it is related to world lines, to set propagation of particles in the presence of gauge fields. And as I told you in the previous time, suppose this gauge field was not an external gauge field. Then, instead of considering this W, you would consider averages of this W. Right? This is all you have to do. we will see that it is a nice, okay, nice is subjective, let me not write, it's a gauge invariant. Non-local observable. This is what we will see next. Then another motivation comes, for example, it is a probe for confinement. It's a nice observable for studying hard quantities, hard questions like confinement in gauge theories and so on. It's also related in a very mysterious way, as I'm going to tell you, to scattering amplitudes. And finally, it's a nice quantity in ADS-CFT. It's one of the nice observables in ADS-CFT, and it's also a very natural observable in lattice QCD. So it's a good excuse to, a good motivation for introducing this lattice quantum field theories is precisely for studying these Wilson loops. There, the formulation of the theory is in terms of these Wilson loops. Very good. So is everyone happy with this motivation and with the logic and with what we have seen so far and so on? Okay, very good. So I want to describe now this Wilson loop as a way of constructing a gauge invariant way of comparing things at two different points in space-time. Okay? A way of propagating things from one point in space-time to another. So before that, let me just write here a reminder. In an Anabelian gauge theory, with the fields in the adjoint, with some fields phi, which are some matrix AB, which in the adjoint, and for example, a very important such theory, for example, n equals 4 super Young Mills, like you saw in John's lectures. We have that a given field at space in space-time under a gauge transformation goes to u of x, phi of x, u minus 1 of x. So this guy is not a gauge invariant operator. Right? How do you construct gauge invariant operators in Anabelian gauge theories? John told you one way. How do we, for example, let me tell, for example, let's suppose I have a product of two such guys, phi of x times phi of x, now they are matrix, it transforms under u, goes to u of x, phi times u minus 1 of x. This is not a gauge invariant operator. Right? The u's in between, they cancel. But how do I make this a gauge invariant operator? Take the trace. So an operator O of x, which is the gauge invariant operator, is the trace of phi times phi. Because of cyclicity of the trace, when I transform, the u's and u minus 1's just cancel out. And these guys, they are dual in ADS-CFT, as John told you, two closed strings. And the closed comes, if you want, from the cyclicity of the trace. This is how we understand in the gauge theory why is there something closed. Cyclicity of the trace. Okay, so this remark will become clear. Why am I making this remark? When we will introduce another way of making gauge invariant operators using Wilson loops. Okay? So, okay, maybe just one more thing about this. What if we insist on constructing something like phi of x times phi at another point y. Now taking the trace doesn't work, but imagine for some reason I want to consider this kind of objects which are more non-local. They are not defined on the same point in space-time, but somehow on two different points of space-time. How do I do it? Okay, and we will see that the answer is by putting a Wilson loop uniting the two operators. Okay, so let's arrive at that conclusion by studying edge invariance properties of Wilson loops. Okay, but the answer is that the Wilson loops are a way of bringing one operator close to the other in a gauge invariant way. So we want to consider Wilson loops, or very complicated loops, but let's start by studying them for some short path, x going to x plus epsilon. Okay. And then we have just the Wilson loop. It's a very small path, so I can say that it's a Wilson loop which goes from x to x plus epsilon. Okay. And this is just the exponential of I g times this epsilon mu a mu. This guy's a matrix. Yeah. Okay, very good. So if epsilon is very small, this is nothing but 1 plus IG epsilon mu A mu. And this transforms under a gauge transformation into 1 plus IG epsilon mu, and then the transformation of A, which is, as you know, u A mu u minus 1 minus, or, okay, I don't remember the sign by heart, I think minus, but okay, u d minus 1. Okay? And this is nothing, again, approximately equal to this order in epsilon, as you can check easily, is nothing but u of x plus epsilon omega from going from point x to epsilon times u minus 1 of x. Okay? If you expand this using that, yeah, if you just expand this, you get that this is nothing but this. Okay, so this sounds interesting. If I have a Wilson loop from two points, it's conjugated under gauge transformations, but the matrix is different at the two ends. It's the matrix at the two ends. Okay? So then, suppose I consider a sequence of this very small gauge of this very small let me suppose I consider a sequence of these very small paths to make a big path. So now I discretize as we did before. Okay? So I discretize now, and I consider now my path as a sequence of such paths. Okay? By this we mean that we have some path going from point y to point x, and this would be the Wilson loop. Okay, written in this way, it should be from x to y, Wilson loop from y minus epsilon at the last step to y, y from y minus epsilon n coming from y minus epsilon n minus epsilon n minus 1, dot dot dot, and then Wilson loop from x to x1 plus epsilon 1. Okay, very good. And now this object, when I make a gauge transformation, transforms into what? What does it transform under? So I know how each of the small guys transform. How does the big guy transform? One in the beginning and one at the very end, because the ones in the middle, for example, this guy cancels, the gauge transformation from the left of this one cancels from the right of this one, because the end point of this is the starting point of this. So they all cancel. So under a gauge, I have u of y, then all my Wilson loop from x to y, and then u minus 1 of x. Okay, cool. So now we know what to do if we really insist on something like this. If we now want to consider, if we really insist on putting some phi at position x, some other field phi at position y, okay, let's just put a Wilson loop between the two from both ends, and this is a gauge invariant object. So phi. So now we can consider, say, expectation value, for example, of this operator, phi of x, then a Wilson loop from point y to point x, then phi of y, and then the Wilson loop from point x to point y. This is what this picture is, right? Now, when you make a gauge transformation, this just transforms by u here and u minus 1 at the very end. So if I just consider a trace of this object, then this is a single trace, non-local, gauge invariant operator. Okay? So it's a non-local, gauge invariant operator. Yes? This doesn't matter much. U times U minus 1. So Ricardo is asking why the derivative acts. If the derivative is acting here, how come is U is the one who is shifted and so on? But okay, U minus 1 is identity. So if you take derivative, you get du U minus 1 plus U du minus 1 equals 0. So you then replace this guy by this derivative. And then the sign changes. That's why I put a minus. Then there is a plus. Then it's really the derivative of U and so on. Very good. Okay. And a particular case of this is just a Wilson loop that doesn't start or end anywhere. So the Wilson loop, C, which would be just, we would start at some point that we mark and consider the path order exponential starting at this point x naught. Okay? This would go to u of x naught, the same Wilson loop, times u minus 1 of x naught. So that's why sometimes it's very useful to consider the trace, because then with the trace, I have trace here, and this is just the Wilson loop. So if I take the trace, then x naught is not important. Before the trace, it is important. You must specify where you start doing your path order exponential. Start at this point, you go around, and you come back to the same point. But the point where you start is important. Okay? It transforms in a very simple way, by conjugation. It transforms like a local operator put at point x naught, but not like a local operator put at some other point. But when you take the trace, it is a gauge invariant operator. Okay, very good. So this ends point two of the motivation. So this is a nice object that we can study, which is gauge invariant. Yes?
Okay, the
bottom
trace there,
this trace?
Yeah, that's just an example of something that's not gauge invariant.
Without trace, this object here, let me call it A, would go under a gauge transformation to u A u minus 1. So again, by taking the trace, I take the trace if I want to get something gauge invariant.
So what is
this? These things are an operator at point x, an operator at point y, connected by connected in a way which makes this object gauge invariant. Okay. If you want some more intuition, you could think that, okay, if I take a trace of many phis, many fields, it looks like a big closed string. Now you could take a product of many fields. But instead of taking the trace, and therefore making a closed string, put a Wilson loop, which starts at the end and goes somewhere else in the world, and put another here that goes to that place, and at that place put another string of big, many fields. Then each of these strings of many fields behaves like an open string, and it would be dual in ADSFT to an open string. Okay? So this is a way of constructing open strings. Closed strings, you take the trace and you get cyclicity. These guys, if you put a chain of fields, then a Wilson loop, then another chain of fields, then another Wilson loop, these chains here, it's not cyclic. I cannot just rotate. They have a beginning and an end. It's an open string. Okay? But, I mean, there's many things I could say about that, but that would take me in a slightly different direction, so I want to move into other important applications of the Wilson loop. So now the next motivation is very neat. It's very physical. It tells you that the Wilson loop also is a nice observable to study confinements. It tells you if you put two charges, Q and minus Q, separated by some distance, what is the force between that charges, those charges. And that, of course, if it decays with distance, they are not confined. If you get a linear potential, a force which increases, then you get confinement. So it's very neat that you can try to answer these questions with Wilson loops and study what is the force between two charges. Okay, but any question before on the gauge invariance and on this more mathematical part? Yeah? No? Okay. So as you know very well, when you do a path integral, dA e to some action of A, okay, and if you do this integral for a very large time, minus the configurations which go from minus t over 2 to t over 2, very large, what happens? What is the path integral computing if the time is very large? No. Time is very large. So the path integral can be a way of writing a partition function, a sum over energies, right? Weighted by the temperature, which is the inverse of the temperature is this huge distance. So what happens when I take this distance to be very large? When I'm computing my sum over states. Which states do I single out? The ground state, right? You probably, when you did it, maybe you were having some ice here, and then you put some ice on T so that you would be sure that it would project to the ground state. You did it, right? So just path integral with a very long time. Normally, this path integral computes the sum of states. And when T is very large, you pick only the ground state. Just as simple as this. Okay, good. So this should give us, okay, e to the minus e0, the energy of a ground state times time. Okay, so now what we do is, instead of considering my path integral over my gauge field, let's add two charges. Okay. One with charge E, the other with charge minus E, separated by some distance r. So the idea is that we put some electron here, some anti-electron here, that is to say an electron that goes back in time, separated by some distance r, and all this happens during this time t. Okay? Then the idea is that when we put these charges, this guy, we will have also the energy due to the potential energy, the interaction energy between the two particles. So if we can understand what does it mean in practice to add these two charges, we can then read this potential V of R. Okay, good. So adding charges, what does it mean really rigorously? So adding charges means that you do your integral dA exponential of your action of A. Okay. And then how do you add sources? You integrate over space-time. Let me really write space-time as dt d3x. you put some source, j mu of x times a mu of x. X, now x here being t and x. Okay, let me write really t and x. Okay, well, in general, this is how you put these sources. What do you want for the sources to represent two static charges, one at some position and the other separated by r? What do you choose for those sources? Come on. I want the source of a static particle. Is it localized everywhere in the universe? If the particle is here? No. It's a delta function. It's just localized where the particle is. So what do we want to choose for J mu? Okay, we want to say that the position, say, is at the origin. And say, if we think it's static, we will choose some delta mu component 0 times E, E being the charge. And then for the other guy, we would put minus, okay, plus a charge at position r, again, component 0, they are static, times minus the charge. But this means that S of A, that what we need, we add to S of A plus integral J mu A mu is nothing but this part here. Okay, this is nothing but action of A plus, let me put an I. Let's put an I. Plus what? I E integral, okay, let me write the final dot. A mu of x of t, x dot mu of t dt, so our nice Wilson loop exponent, where what is x of t? X mu is just t 0, 0, 0. And how to write it properly? Let's see. Let's write this the left. So this is the left. And then there is plus I E integral A mu of X right X mu dot right dt, where X mu right would be the path which evolves in time. Okay, now I put the charge with positive, so I should put minus t here and say, for example, 0, 0, r. Okay, cool. So this is precisely what we say. We say we have the gauge field coupled to a particle which is quiet, just moving in time. Just time is evolving and the particle is at the origin in space. And here is another particle which is at some position r in space and evolving in time with opposite sign because the charge is negative. So what we have is almost the Wilson loop, except that it's not closed. But we have just this contour here, okay? So we have this contour, and we have here a mu times x dot mu here, and then a mu times x mu dot here. And this is exactly what we have, okay? Okay, is this clear? So then this part is a contour like this here, and nothing happens here. And this one is a contour like this here, and nothing happens here. So it's almost computing the expectation value of the Wilson loop. We are almost adding the Wilson loop, but not quite, because to add the Wilson loop, we would need to close it into a loop to make something gauge invariant. Do you allow me to close it into a loop? You should, because t is so large, who cares if I put a small cap up there. The really important thing is you have this huge propagation here. What happens up there and down there is irrelevant. Right? It's just our intuition. This t is huge, this r is fixed. Okay, so we can always close this. I mean, after all, this is small compared to t, so who cares what I do at infinity? And what we conclude is that the conclusion is therefore that e to the minus t times potential of r is equal to the path integral dA. Okay, we can divide by the vacuum energy to subtract the vacuum energy to have really just the interaction energy, no E0. This is really much more physical. Integrate over A, exponential of the action of A, and then I have my Wilson loop for what contour? For a rectangular contour. Okay? For a rectangle like this, or in the way I drew it before, it was rather like this. Where this distance is r and this distance is t. This is the Wilson loop. In other words, it's nothing but the expectation value of the Wilson loop for this rectangular contour. Okay, cool. So this, I think you cannot get more physical than this with an application of something. So you are really computing the energy, interaction energy between two charges in the presence of the gauge field. Is everyone happy? Cool. So, wow, we are going very fast today, it seems. Am I going too fast? No? Cool. So... Sorry? Yeah, so then ask questions. So what are you confused about? You want me to repeat some point?
Is there an easy example you can do quickly, or is it?
Absolutely, that's what we are going to do now. Let's compute then this for QED. What do you expect for QED? Absolutely. So 1 over r potential, right? So let's derive that. So, perfect. So, since Alex proposed, let's do QED. So what is our action for our gauge field A? Well, it's just integral over space-time, f mu nu. Okay? We can choose a gauge where the propagator between two points, x and y, this, I think it's probably Feynman gauge, I'm not sure. Yeah, Feynman gauge. This would be just, now the propagator has indices, mu nu, right? It's a gluon. There is just delta mu nu integral d4k over 2 pi to the 4 e to the ik x minus y over k square, just a Fourier transform of k square. And this is equal to 1 over 4 pi square x minus y square times delta mu nu. We are doing Euclidean. I'm not taking out Minkowski matrix. Okay. Is everyone happy with this? Is it clear that it should be 1 over x minus y square in position space, the propagator? Normally you are used to momentum space, but in position space is difference of distance is square. Is it clear to everyone? Can someone give me an argument why it is this? Sorry? Yeah, gauge field, as I mentioned, the theory is free, so it's conformal. It must be 1 over the distance to the power 2 times dimension, which is 2. That's one way. Another way is just if you see that if you rescale k by the absolute value of x minus y, and if you see a 4 powers here, 2 powers here, this comes out, and it's this up to a number. And otherwise, I mean, yeah, that's it. That's enough. The best answer is it has dimension 1. Okay, very good. So that's the propagator. So let's then compute this Wilson loop. Okay. Now there's nothing to trace. And indeed, this is a gauge invariant operator by itself. Just if it's a loop, as we saw yesterday. So let's compute the Wilson loop, but let's do it for a general contour, not for the rectangle. So what is this? So this is 1 plus, let's do it to leading order in perturbation theory. Okay? So this is 1 plus the integral around this contour of a mu of t, x dot mu of t, dt, plus integral, 2 integrals, a mu of t1, x dot mu of t1, a mu x of t2, x dot mu of t2, dt1, dt2, plus dot dot dot. This one there is a power of electric charge, E. Here there is E square over 2, plus dot dot. This is a boolean, the order doesn't matter, this is just exponential, this is just expanding an exponential. What we want to compute is not the Wilson loop, but the average of the Wilson loop. The average of the Wilson loop is 1 plus the average of this guy plus the average of this guy plus the average of this guy. How much is the average of the first guy? The average of A. 0. The average of just a single field is 0. I have no one-point function. There's nothing you could write with one index if you want. With one index. Okay. And if you try to compute the perturbation theory, what can you do? You cannot do nothing. It's just integrating a Gaussian. It's the same as integral of x e to the minus x squared. It's odd, and you get 0. Okay? So this guy is 0. What about this guy? Okay, of course, the propagator is nothing, but in a particular gauge, the average of x mu of x, a nu of y, this is what this guy is. So okay, we know how to average, so we know how to compute it for the second guy. And for the second term we get, so we get that the average of the Wilson loop for a generic contour C is equal to 1 plus E squared over 2, this contour integral, and then we have, let's do here just some, the propagator has this delta mu nu, which contracts with x dot mu of t1 and then x dot nu of t2. This is just the inner product between the two vectors. So what we get is upstairs we get x dot of t1 inner product with x dot of t2 divided by the propagator, which is the distance between x at position t1 minus x at position t2 squared. Diagrammatically, what this is this is equal to 1 plus, and then we have our loop, and we have one point, and the gluon leaves one point and goes interact with the other particle at another point, and we integrate over the possible positions. Okay? And this is a quantum process. And if you now continue, it's a more quantum process, and indeed there are higher powers of E. So if you want to compute it to leading order, we just keep this, if you want. Okay, but actually, let me comment on the higher orders first. So first, we want now the term of order E squared. But actually, in this case, because it's free, we can get all the orders very easily. But let me discuss that a bit later. Okay, very good. No, actually, I want to do it now. Sorry, I want to do it now. So, okay, what happens now if I go to, if I go to the next order, to E cube? E cube, I have 3 A's, and again, I'm doing a Gaussian integral, 0. Yes. Sure, you tell me.
The overall starting points and end points for that blue one.
This integral here?
Yeah.
I'm integrating over dt1 and dt2. T1 and t2 being parameters, which tells me how I go along this slope. Okay, maybe there is a good point that you might have raised, which is, what if I choose a different parameterization? Two people choose two different parameterizations. So you choose t, someone else chooses another t prime. But then you see that the way this is defined, you have derivative with respect to t. So this is just dx mu dt, right? And this guy is dt. So if you both change your definition, nothing changes in this expression. It's parameterization invariant. In other words, all this is just dx mu, which is something geometrical. No notion of parameterization. Okay? And this is why all this stuff can also be written as just integral of A, which emphasizes that there are no coordinates, nothing, and so on. Okay, but any parameterization is okay. You can use whatever you want. It gives the same. If you multiply, if you use a parameterization which goes from 0 to 1 million instead of 0 to 1, then you also need to divide here by 1 million, and it's the same. Is this, are you happy with this? No. Okay, so you have x of t, some contour.
Traversing from one side to the other, the loop.
Yes.
Are you?
Okay, you want me to put labels here? So this would be x at position t1, this would be x at position t2, and the propagator between the two is this denominator.
And so you're integrating over...
And I'm integrating where I put
that.
Yes. Okay, sorry. Yeah. So you draw this, and you sum over all possible positions of putting them. This is what this integral dt1 and dt2 do.
Thanks.
Very good. So if you go to higher loop, so we get that the feature is 1 plus, then the loop with 1 plus 1, with e squared. Then there is e4 over 4, because 3, 4 factorial, because with 3 you get nothing. And here you can have the glue one, or you can have another glue. Okay? But notice that this is just this guy, where I integrate over, of course, squared. Because, I mean, the glue ones are free. It's QED. Right? It's not a glue one, I should call it photon. The photons don't know that it's linear. It's a linear theory, right? So it's a free theory. So, of course, this guy is just this guy squared. And so on. So all we have to do is really compute this. This is all we need. Since QED is free. And the expectation of the Wilson loop is just equal to the exponential. All these rhymes, they exponentiate. They are just the one loop square and so on. So if you resum, they just exponentiate to the exponential of e square times integral around, times the one loop result. dt1, dt2, x dot of t1 dotted with x dot of t2 over the distance x of t1 minus x of t2. Okay, good. So this is in QED for any contour C. You integrate over this contour. So this is the value of this observable in QED. It's exact. This. There's no perturbative approximation. So what we want is to compare, to compute this. So if you compute this guy for the rectangle, we get e to the minus d of r times t. So what we are saying, okay, there are some i's, right? I put some i's. So when I square, there is a minus. Actually, here there is a minus. So what I want is to compute v of r times t. I need to compute this integral here. Okay? Is this okay? Because as we argued before, for a rectangle, this is what it is. So I should specify on the case of a rectangle, compute this, and read off what the potential for QVD is. Okay, I think it's a bit of a pity to stop before finishing, which is one page, but it means that I will go slightly over time, like 5 minutes over time. Do you prefer me to stop or to just finish this computation for the rectangle? Okay, so if we all survive, that's okay. So now we want to do this for the rectangle. And basically, we have three types of contributions. The gluon can go from this part to this part. The gluon could go from this part to this part. We could also have... Okay, let me call everyone else boring. Why boring? Because these diagrams are clear that they might contribute a lot. Because, I mean, I'm integrating over all this portion of time. And here they can be everywhere here. And by this boring, I mean the ones that certainly do not scale with large t. which are, for example, the one where I have the gluons going from here to here, etc. I'm not sure if I will compute them or not, probably not. These are boring because R is much smaller than T, and these diagrams certainly don't know about T, so they can never contribute to the potential. They will be subleading terms when T goes to infinity. Right. Such thing doesn't know where is T. I didn't even draw the end of the square. How could he know? Okay, good. So what does this guy give? Let's write explicitly what this is. This is integral, okay, from 0 to capital T, integral from 0 to capital T, just usual integrals, dx, dy, I'm choosing a parameterization where I just parameterized in this way, over x minus y squared plus r squared. Okay? So just choose a parameterization where x of t is just a static charge, like the one we saw before, this guy as well. The inner product is just 1, right? X prime, x dot, I recall that x dot is just 1, 0, 0, 0. In both cases, the inner product is just 1. There's nothing there. I just integrate dt1, dt2, which I call dx, dy. And then the distance between the two points, it's always separated by r. There is a separation by r square. And, okay, let me draw them in this way. So there is this separation here by r, and this is just, and then there is, if this is y, this is x, this is just Pythagoras theorem, right? Just x minus y squared plus r squared gives that distance squared. Okay? So just a triangle. Okay, this is an integral we should do. And then there is this guy. What is this guy? This is just integral, the same thing, dx dy, over x minus y squared. And now, so what is this? So let me call this 1, and let me call this 2. So 1, if you compute 1, you get the following. You get a term linear in t, which is pi t over r, minus 2, log t over r. These are just usual one-dimensional integrals. Mathematica can do them. Minus 2 plus stuff which is suppressed when t goes to infinity. This we don't care. It goes to 0 when t goes to infinity. 2 is equal to 2t over a minus 2 log t over a plus something of order 1. Someone has a guess for what this A is? I didn't introduce it yet. I'm introducing another dimensionful quantity, A. It's dimensionful. That's the dimensions of a distance, like T or R. Why would I be putting this there? Who said something? No one said nothing. Okay. Who wants to say something?
Some short scale distance. So
some short scale distance. Because when these points approach, okay, this is divergent when they approach. Okay. So this is some UV cutoff. Okay? So I don't let, when I have my Wilson loop, if the points are too close, I don't let them approach more than certain distance. Okay, this is like some minimal distance. And if it's smaller than that distance, we don't allow. It's a cutoff. We put a cutoff on the theory. Okay? So now, this is very general for any loop. So let me, before moving on with a rectangle, let me make a comment which is valid for any loop. So when you have a loop, this divergence, when this is A, is always there. Okay, so this divergence is always there. And if it is at some given point here, it's also at this point, it's also at this point, and so on. So you integrate over dt1 and dt2. Fix t1. Then when t2 is approaching t1, you get a divergence. But now you can move T1 over all the loop. So that divergence is multiplied by the length of the loop. Right? So this guy is proportional to L times 1 over A times some number. Some pi's or some 2's or whatever. Okay? So it means that this Wilson loop here, sorry, may I comment, may I continue my comment here? So this Wilson loop here will also contain a part, so contains a divergence, which is of the form exponential of minus some constant L over A. Let me write L as length. Length over A. Okay? In other words, the object that is a finite object, the Wilson loop is not finite. The Wilson loop renormalized, which is what? Which is the exponential of the integral of I e a mu x of mu of t dt. If that constant comes with minus sign, I put it explicitly here with plus sign. Plus c over a integral ds. This is nothing but the length. Or I can write this as integral dt square root of x dot square. Okay? It's finite. Now, this should be inspiring. What is this doing? This is telling me that when I couple a particle, okay? The Wilson loop is what we get when you couple a particle to an electric field. What it's telling you is that you generate a divergence which is proportional to the length. But what was the action for a particle which when it's moving around the contour? It's just the length times the mass. So all this is doing is mass renormalization. That is, in other words, this is just self-energy, which makes perfect sense. It's just some quantum effect. That means that I need to renormalize my parameters. So if I start to doing my world line and I have some bare mass, the physical mass is that bare mass plus this, and that's the finite quantity that you keep fixed when you take the continuum length. Okay? So pragmatically, what does it mean? It means that we know that we always get this stuff, we know that they are mass renormalization, and we drop it. Okay? We know what the physical meaning, they are very well isolated. When you find the divergence proportional to the perimeter, you just ignore it. Okay? You know what they are. They are just self-energies. Okay, so let's see that. Let's see what our result is. Okay? Our result, then, putting contributions 1 and 2 together, tells you that the expectation value of the Wilson loop for this rectangle, let's for now keep the divergences, to emphasize again, it's e to the minus t. And then we have two terms, e square over a pi square a. And this is again what I said to you. This is what you can think as self-energy. You see, it doesn't depend on r. Bless you. And then, minus, as Felix anticipated, e square over 4 pi square r square, and this is nothing but the Coulomb potential. Okay, cool. So, so okay, we understand that we have some contribution, it's divergent, it's okay, it's proportional to the length that a particle propagates, this is just some self-energy. It's not measurable. And then we have something which is measurable, which changes as we change the distance. It tells you that it decays with the distance, which is the Coulomb potential. Okay? So this is like a correction to the vacuum energy, right? It doesn't depend on R. So it just corrects the energy. Just so that if you put two particles of this mass, they get this quantum correction to their mass, and this is the correction to the vacuum energy because of these quantum corrections. This is the juicy part, the interesting part. It tells you the potential V of R as R increases. Very good. I think that's it for today. Okay. Let's continue tomorrow at the usual time.